Did you notice that this was produced by Danny DeVito?
I did not notice that. Is there a story behind that?
I don't know. So I see, I don't know if like he knew him through another actor or whatever, but like I was just watching the credits and it was just like produced by Zach Braff, Danny DeVito, and some other person. I was like, Danny fucking DeVito.
I mean, Danny DeVito gets into some weird shit. Remember, he was in talks to be in Mystery Men?
Was he now?
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, it's normal now, but it was very weird when he decided to be on It's Always in Sunny.
It was super weird.
It's Always Sunny. And he's been on that show for like 15 years, and his character just keeps getting more and more bizarre.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, he's not one for an unusual career choice or maybe, you know, popping up in an odd place. But, yeah. Hello and welcome to Subject to Blackout. My name is Timo, and with me as always is Mike from the Name Taken Podcast. Mike, how you doing?
Good, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing great. This past week, we decided to revisit the 2004 Zach Braff written, directed, and acted movie, Garden State.
He Goodwill hunting the fuck out of that movie.
He really did. Mike, I don't know when the last time you saw this was, but this was a very popular movie right when we were in high school or junior high. And Mike, what'd you think?
I mean, I think even saying it was a very popular movie underrepresents its significance for our era. But we were in high school, and it was a pretty key cultural touch point for like a couple reasons. Like the first being that it was really the beginning of this slew of movies that I think would become a very clear kind of 2000s like film aesthetic. And the second thing was that like at the beginning of social media, one of the kind of signaling points people would use to indicate sort of where they situated themselves culturally was the Garden State soundtrack.
Yeah.
So I've definitely listened to songs from the soundtrack. I always know that they're from Garden State, so I always have a feeling about them. And I probably haven't seen the movie 15 years. Maybe it's got to be about 15 years since I've seen it.
Yeah, it had been a minute for me too.
Yeah.
And again, during the pandemic, just kind of like Rush Hour, I just got a wild hair to see if the movie stood up. And yeah, I mean, for me, it had probably been at some point in college. So yeah, close to 12 to 15 years ago since I last saw it. And my takeaway a few months ago was what my takeaway the other night when I watched it again was this movie is a really good movie, and it's not perfect, and there are some things about it that are very of a time and of a place, and you know, some of that is the somewhat over emotional moments of it,
right?
But man, I remember after not seeing this for the longest time thinking, holy shit, that was a lot funnier than I remembered.
That I agree with that. I mean, I what I really wanted to find out revisiting this movie was, am I critical of the movie or am I critical of the hype?
Yeah.
Which, and at this point, it had been so long that I couldn't possibly guess where one ended and the other began. But like, it has a number of like really, really clever, funny scenes. At the funeral, where the woman is singing Three Times a Lady,
but
it's Ave Maria.
And she's, her makeup is so messed up because she's obviously been sobbing.
God, I forgot about that scene completely, but I thought that was really clever.
Yeah, that, and you know, yeah, that scene's amazing. I really love the scene where the shit character Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory is
medieval a times.
Medieval times night. But they just smash cut to like Zach Braff waking up on a couch to the sound of someone in full suit of armor walking around the kitchen. Oh my God. I was laughing. And then that scene ends with like, by the way, it says balls on your face. it's just so ridiculous and perfect. And actually that sets up a sight gag a little bit later in the movie. So yeah, no, I mean, I felt like there was a lot to like. Again, this movie is far from perfect. But yeah, I mean, I think now would be a good time to get into the nitty gritty. I feel like one of the things that I don't love about the movie is about the first half of Natalie Portman's performance.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of settles into a character that feels less ridiculous. Like she's over the top in a way at the beginning that, like, I know people like that, but I don't want to see people like that in movies necessarily because they're pretty annoying. And it, at the beginning of the film, you think, like, how is it that Zach Braff is going to fall for this girl? She's a lying child. And, you know, this film comes out about 3 years before the term is even coined, but like
Manic Pixie chick?
Yeah, she does. Is like sort of a proto Manic Pixie. But again, like in the second half of the movie, that kind of gets better. She kind of becomes a more relatable, more understandable character. So I can't be too critical because it just doesn't work for me in a couple scenes. But man, at the beginning of this film gets me a little worried because her and a couple of the first scenes just feel like vignettes and they don't feel connected to the plot. But once you meet Natalie Portman and the plot starts going in a specific direction, I think the movie really finds itself and takes off.
Yeah, I mean, the scene that I remembered, I don't know if I even remembered the kind of the narrative very strongly. I remembered broadly what the movie was about, but I mean, for me, the scene that sticks out in my mind is really like the key thing that redeems or humanizes that early kind of like one-dimensional Natalie Portman character. And that's the scene where she gives Zach Braff her headphones to listen to the Shins.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, that was the one of the key scenes. I mean, I think the other big key scene is the sitting, the kind of fast motion on the plane at the end was kind of another iconic scene, but the handing over the headphones scene was pretty iconic for the time.
Yes.
But otherwise, yeah, she is kind of like kind of a frenzy, and just kind of like a foil for Zach Braff. Like, yeah, in retrospect, I don't necessarily think that there's a problem with creating characters that are there simply to kind of push forward the growth or experience of the main character. But yeah, if this movie was being made now, they would definitely approach, you know, like Portman's character a little bit differently.
You would at least hope so. Yeah.
What one thing, because I knew that we would approach watching this differently. And whereas I have a feeling that you're in a much better position to talk about revisiting some of the plot and pacing and also some of the kind of like kind of structural elements. One of the things that I spent most of my time thinking about was cultural context, because like I said, like that it was a cultural phenomenon and a cultural touch point. Really, I mean, for our generation and for the 2000s, like it's hard to believe, but when you think about it, Zach Braff was like the fucking prom king
of
the decade. But one of the things that I wrote down here was the 2000s and hysterical realism. That Garden State really introduced this kind of like absurd kind of real life aesthetic that ended up being all over the place after Garden State. And the movies that I wrote down that I was thinking of, even within 2 or 3 years of this one, were Napoleon Dynamite, Royal Tenenbaums, I Heart Huckabees, Eternal Sunshine, Lost in Translation, which I think was actually just like a year before this one. So this kicked off a number of movies that sort of made real life completely odd and absurd.
Mm-hmm.
It even uses some of these elements that like you would even see in like fantasy or sci-fi at the end of the decade, like that kind of green tint, like on some of the more serious scenes to make things feel a little bit more unsettled.
Mm-hmm.
You would even see that in places like Harry Potter, which was kind of bizarre at the end of the decade. So there were things about this that were really iconic. And one of the things that was that overarching kind of hysterical realist feel.
Yeah, no, I mean, it has a vibe and a feeling that was so unfamiliar in the landscape. You know, this is, you know, if you want to call this an indie movie, like, this is the first indie movie I remember being like,
oh, yeah,
a mainstream, oh, yeah, you have to see this movie type thing. And I mean, part of that is everyone at about that age sees their first independent movie. I mean, I also saw Clerks sometime around, you know, around high school. So while it wasn't released at that time, so I don't remember that very much, but like that was another, like, for our generation, one of the first independent films that you'd see. And this movie in particular was just so much a forebearer of what was about to come in television and film. And honestly, it opened up an experience to through the soundtrack to a bunch of bands that people hadn't really, you know, known much about, if anything at all. So, I mean, yeah, it was definitely a cultural touchstone in that way. I also think it's pretty amazing that, considering this is Zach Braff's directorial debut and, you know, this is obviously his first film, there are a bunch of really excellent just shots and really, really clever like sight gags, like when you're in the neurologist's office and Zach Braff is just looking at all the diplomas. You almost get like a Wes Anderson-esque like tilt up to the wooden diploma that's on the ceiling. And it's just adorable. And it's like, wow, like I can't, like, it almost makes me want to watch another Zach Braff directed movie, which nothing makes me want to watch another Zach Braff directed movie. But like, there's that. There's the overhead like crane shot when they're all jumping in the pool.
I loved that. Was the one I was thinking of when you just said that. I thought that was great.
The decision to make it that overhead shot is so dramatic. Again, very kind of Wes Anderson, even before Wes Anderson's like style had so emphatically crystallized years later. But yeah, and then like a subtle push in as it shows his isolation from, you know, his former high school friends and stuff. Like, just really, really great work. And I don't know who the cinematographer was on this film and how much they played a part in that decision, but either Zach Braff had a very strong vision or he was smart enough to let others influence his decisions.
The other scene that I also wrote down, very Wes Anderson-esque, was he's trying on the shirt and it happens to be the exact same print as the wallpaper that he was standing in front of.
Yes.
And they also do that kind of flat lighting.
Yes.
So he blends really, which is like very, like a very Wes Anderson kind of straight ahead shots without a whole lot of depth.
Yeah, I also thought the like old CRT television where they're watching the alligator ice skating performance.
Yeah.
I thought all of the fingerprints being all over the TV, there was just something about that was like, oh, that's Wes Anderson. Like,
right.
Because they didn't feel like real fingerprints. Why were there that many fingerprints on their TV? I know that he was dusting for fingerprints, so they were just highlighted. But like, there's just something about that just felt, you know, perfect, like right out of Royal Tenenbaums, right out of Fantastic Mr. Fox, something like that. So I think one of the reasons why this film was so widely accepted by, you know, our age group and by the culture in general is because it just hit a bunch of touchstones that a lot of other films weren't really delving into. One specifically is that, like, what he articulates in the shallow end of the pool to Natalie Portman is that a house is not your home. You know, it's just a place that you all collectively remember, you know, and it's something that you can't really attain again, especially at the time, like, you know, leaving for college a few years after this and then going back home for the first time, like, that absolutely is the, like, I definitely was at my home, but it didn't feel like my home anymore. And, like, the idea that, like, you lose that and maybe, like, that's what a home is just the same place that you're all, like, you know, wishing you were at. Like, that whole concept is a very intelligent and well executed, like, idea by a first-time director.
I would even take it one step further and say that, like, the particular theme of detachment and alienation, which, like, in part is communicated by being, like, medicated, that he's sort of, like, numb to the world around him, but was a very particular type of post 9/11 kind of, like, teenage and young adult arena in the arts. Mm-hmm. Before the financial crisis.
Yeah. So, yeah, right in between two of the, like, four crises that we've lived through.
But there was a type of sort of, like, sudden introspection that I think comes through in a lot of films from this era that, like, is veering towards cynicism, but it's sort of like it's a lack of confidence and also, like, a sense of detachment that definitely changes significantly after 2008.
Yeah, and in this film, you can feel that the character is fighting that sense of detachment.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, like, following 2001, like, everything, you know, I mean, that was the day where, as, you know, children, we were in eighth grade at the time of the September 11th attacks. Like, that day, you, like, learned that the world was cruel and scary and uncontrolled, and, like, you became, in a way that, you know, generations before us didn't have since, you know, Pearl Harbor or whatever, this moment where suddenly, like, your mom and dad can't protect you if someone wants to fly a plane into your house, you know? Like, there's just nothing that you can do, and that's a sudden and significant change where you realize, like, any safety you felt you had as a child, that idea was shattered that day. And, like, this movie sort of confronts that feeling and goes, all right, well, but can we fake it? Like, can we pretend that, you know, we don't have to be cynical about our current situation?
We sure can. We sure can pretend. We just have to run to the arms of Zach Braff, to the open arms of Zach Braff.
Well, and I think you bring up a good point about him being, like, physically medicated. Like, the whole, like, inciting incident of this character's life is that his mother is just emotionally crippled for reasons he doesn't understand and will never understand. And I guess it's not really important as to why. So he accidentally physically cripples his mother, and then as a result, he gets emotionally crippled by these drugs and just basically feels like he can't feel anything anymore. And I don't know if that's the most perfect symbology for what he's going through, but, like, it's, again, for first-time writer-director, it's not nothing that he makes that connection to physical and emotional pain being, if not equal, then at least related.
Again, one of the most challenging things for me coming back to this movie, and I'm, and in a way, I'm glad that we did it under this context, because I don't think I would have gone back to this movie under another context. But it became such a big deal that it reached that critical mass where then it just, like, received a huge amount of backlash. And then it was the butt of jokes, like Dane Cook. So remember, he went platinum. A lot of people bought that CD.
He was selling out arenas while his brother was stealing all of his money.
Yeah. So there was, like, he got big enough to the point of backlash that even there's that Broad City episode where, there's a character who's, like, meant to be kind of obnoxious and overly positive, And he, one of the things he talks about casually is how he donated a bunch of money to Zach Braff's Kickstarter because he loved Garden State so much.
Yeah, like
I would have been much more critical of Zach Braff in part because of that joke, but it's a lot to be a first-time director and the writer and also to hand curate soundtrack.
It's and to be the lead actor.
Yeah, it's impressive to do all of those things.
Yeah, and I mean, again, and do not a perfect movie, job. But yeah. Knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
I did also like that there is the scene where he just kind of walks into the bathroom where his mother, you know, either committed suicide or accidentally drowned, whichever you take away from the plot.
That was it. Yeah, I forgot about that, but that's such interesting ambiguity. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I took that away as more of like that was there's parts of this movie which are just like slapstick comedy and yeah. and very funny. And then there's these parts where Zach Braff like has a point to make and like it's cool that he has both of those.
Right.
Again, I'm super impressed going back and looking at this.
Yeah.
But like, you know, the tub that, you know, she installed a few weeks before her death is leaking and Zach Braff can't fix it. Like he couldn't fix her emotional problems.
Right.
And it's just like, man, it you know, it's not super subtle. It's there at the surface if you want to see it. But boy, like, again, like these physical themes where the characters don't have to state like, hey, this is just like when my mother was sad. Like he just does it visually and just says like, no matter what I do, I can't fix those problems. Like, I think he should be commended for how excellent this film turned out. Again, I have never seen another Zach Braff film because, ooh, I've heard things. but, like, I could, ooh, this almost makes me want to see one of those again because, or one of those for the first time because there's just a lot in this where it's like, man, this guy has an eye for things and he knows what he's going for and he has a point. And, you know, you look at a lot of young directors and they can do some interesting visual things or tell some interesting stories, but do they have a message? Do they have a, you know, a thing that they're trying to tell the audience? And Zach Braff definitely had that.
Yeah, I think it's true. It's so tough to stay on point and to stay organized and to like maintain the scope of these types of projects. That's really the thing that people get lost in the weeds about. And for somebody who is all of the key roles, like there were definitely elements of this movie that are self-indulgent, but it wasn't so self-indulgent that it lost the plot.
Yeah.
Which was, and so obviously like in that case, you kind of like, you know, you allow it. Right. Like,
yeah.
Sure.
I mean, there's definitely a couple sojourns in the plot in the movie where you're like, why are we doing this?
Right.
Like, I mean, specifically, the second half of the plot is giant sojourns that are increasingly annoying to, you know, Zach Braff and Natalie Portman because they just want to spend time together. And
right.
His idiot friend keeps making them do all these weird things. Like have the guy from Super Troopers like try to talk them into like a pyramid scheme.
Yeah, I love that.
But again, I mean, I think Roger Ebert put it like this movie feels like it, you know, has some asides, but like you don't really mind them all that much because they're kind of fun.
Yeah.
And that's true. Like I said, like some of the beginning feels just like vignettes and Zach Braff talked about it at the time. He was like, yeah, some of those early scenes are just stuff that happened in my life that I just wanted to like put on film because like the waiting the table at the restaurant, you could cut that from the film. But like that girl asking for bread is just such an asshole.
You don't have bread.
What do you mean you don't have bread? We're a Vietnamese restaurant.
But you're not Vietnamese.
And it's so, I mean, with all the Karens we see in the world these days, like, of course this actually happened to him. Yeah, it's like stuff like that is really excellent. And again, you don't mind the little, you know, detour off the path, because when what this film lets you know quickly is when you're going away from the plot, it's probably because he's trying to lighten the mood with some funny story, and it's probably going to be funny. Mike, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Raise your hand if you just saw some titties.
Was that Method Man?
That was Method Man. I don't know why he's in this movie. But yeah, that was Method Man, and he plays a delightful little side character who we see for no reason, and we experience a bizarre and otherworldly little event. But again, it's just there's a little button on every one of those scenes where it's just funny enough to be like, all right, I'll follow you.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I've had the Garden City soundtrack playing in the background the entire time we've been talking.
I have not been doing that, but that's good to know. I'm just glad it's not Maneater.
It could be.
It probably will be for the rest of the pod. Well, since we're talking a little bit about the soundtrack, in the context of the film, as to when it like starts playing and in the scene, what were some of or one of your favorite needle drops?
I mean, that I mentioned it earlier, but the iconic scene where Natalie Portman introduces the Shins and then hands over the headphones and New Slang is playing. And even when he takes off the headphones there, you can still hear the music. Mm-hmm. I mean, that scene is just like, it's a perfect scene because he puts the music on, but the focus is on Natalie Portman. Which, by the way, too, like at this point in Natalie Portman's career, right? We knew her from Leon the Professional. We knew her as Queen Amidala. Like, this is really like one of her key moments where it's like, actually, you know, I'm a pretty good adult actress.
Yeah.
Like, don't let George Lucas fool you. I can actually act.
He told me to act like I couldn't act. It's not my fault.
That scene is great. And then,
Anakin, why are you doing this to us?
Yeah, you've been so awesome and I'm in love with you.
I'm pregnant. I hope no one finds out. Also, I'm 9 months pregnant.
Yeah, and like sometimes genocide just makes you feel icky. It's okay.
Anakin, what are your thoughts about sand?
Yeah, and sand women and sand children.
Yeah, that was an overshare by Anakin. He's like, not just the men, the women and the children. She's like, I didn't need to know that.
Yeah.
Like, we're done. You know that, right? Like, you can't commit genocide and we're still cool.
No, she was like, sploosh, I love you more.
Oh my God, I hate sand people. It's like, wow, she's a racist. Wow.
And she was like, have you ever listened to the Shins? He's like, I don't know.
Maybe they'll calm you the fuck down. You got a real attitude problem, Annie.
The other scene, because there are allusions throughout the movie to The Graduate, and the other scene that I liked was it, like everything in the entire soundtrack is like different flavors of like Nick Drake. Like, let's be honest.
Yeah. And that's one of mine is when one of these things first comes on.
Yeah,
by Nick Drake in the movie, like it sets a perfect scene.
Yeah, well, I like hearing The Only Living Boy in New York as like kind of a nod to The Graduate, as like a Simon and Garfunkel tune. I thought that was neat, and that was when they're standing in the rain on top of that car and they do that kind of super zoom.
Yeah. I also like Let Go by Frau Frau.
Oh gosh, yeah, that's a great song that I forgot about.
It is so good, and I always think of it as an Imogen Heap song, which, I mean, she's the singer.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I every time I see the band name Frau Frau, I'm like, oh, yeah, I wish it was under the name Imogen Heap. But, yeah, I mean, the way that song plays during the, you know, fast-forwarded airplane scene, yeah, just like you were mentioning, like, it perfectly encapsulates like the flux his life is in. And then when he makes the surprise decision that you're not expecting to actually just be like, oh, fuck it, you know, my career isn't anything anyway. I might as well stay here and just like spend some time with you.
Right.
And then they kiss and it switches to like a handheld pan out, like the cameraman's just walking away from them in an actual airport. There's something about that transition where like the film stock feels different. And you're I don't know if they actually changed like the film stock or the frames per second that they were shooting at, but there's just something about it that once that kiss happens, it feels visually different. And I think that's that song playing in the background just emphasizes this whole new world that they could be, you know, setting off into with each other.
I think I had a different interpretation of that final scene. I like that you went there. But when I was watching it, this movie still predates this other one I'm going to mention, but like in the closure of Eternal Sunshine, you kind of are left with this sense that like these two people are going to keep meeting each other and hating each other and then forgetting about each other for eternity. And you can take from that whether that's positive or just like existentially horrifying. Like it's entirely up to you. And I got sort of like flashes of that at the end of this movie, that like this could be an absolutely terrible decision from a person who has kind of like no emotional maturity, but who's off pills for
the first time in like 12 years.
Right. So I thought that was actually kind of interesting at the end, but I was interpreting it through, again, like other films of the era.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to look at this from perspective of like mental health, it's probably not the greatest story in the world to be like, if you stop taking your drugs one day, you'll be better than you've ever been.
Right.
Like maybe that's not true.
I would say, I mean, one thing to remember, I agree with you, but I think they handled that, or at least they lampshaded it, that in the scene with the psychiatrist, at no point does he say go cold turkey.
Yeah.
He's
like, maybe you should talk to your doctor about that.
Exactly.
Which is, yeah, I mean, that's good covering your ass and also like, yeah, sound reasoning, which that the doctor played by Ron Liebman is just delightful.
Yeah, it was great casting. Really good casting.
All over the place. Really great casting.
Bilbo Baggins is his dad. Totally forgot about that.
The recently deceased Ian Holm. Yeah. May he rest in the most peace. Peter Sarsgaard playing the type of character Peter Sarsgaard was supposed to play.
Absolutely.
Which is like kind of a scuzzy dirtbag.
Yeah, but still like really
with
charismatic.
A heart of gold. He's like, yeah, I sold your mom, your dead mom's jewelry, but I got it back. Yeah. Yeah, Method Man, Kenny the cop, who's like, shut the fuck up. And then he realizes that it's Largeman. And he's like, so how was I? Well, I thought you were an asshole. All right. Like, just the perfect type of just dumb idiot cop role. Yeah, no, all over the place. The guy who plays Tetembe was fucking hilarious.
It's funny. Yeah.
Yeah, there's and then of course Jeffrey Arend, who's the guy from the Snozzberries Taste Like Snozzberries.
Yes.
in Super Troopers.
Yeah, there were some really good comedian choices to have just kind of in the background.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I do, again, I guess credit to Zach Braff, but one of the things that, I mean, it's a movie that like definitely the characters are developed, or at least the story is developed enough that it maintains an emotional impact. It was something that, like, at least we remembered the feeling of this movie 15 years later. It was extremely easy to recall the feeling of this movie, even if we couldn't recall all the plot points, like, which I think is meaningful. You know, like there are other movies where you just watch them and completely forget about them, like David Harbour's Hellboy.
This one.
This is not that movie.
I didn't even see that one coming. That one was actually good. Normally, I can see him coming from a mile away. You sack of shit. I think I cut the last one out of the last pod, so people don't know that you successfully did it, but you've successfully mentioned David Harbour's Hellboy in every single pod.
Yeah, but I mean, but my point stands that this movie has enough of an emotional punch that you can recall it. Yeah.
Before you ruined it, you were making a very nice point, yeah. But like that's when you were saying that before you were an asshole, I was thinking, like, yeah, you're right. But I think one of the things that got lost with the unnecessary and I would say unfair backlash to Zach Braff, just because he was kind of like,
yeah,
you know, too hot to trot for a little bit. And he got up his own ass. So it's not entirely undeserved. Yep. But the film doesn't deserve any of that backlash. Like, and I think with it kind of falling off of the cultural, like, zeitgeist, you know, falling out of fashion, mm-hmm. we're really losing what is a super funny film.
Yeah.
Again, I cannot stress how, like, if you haven't seen this movie or if you haven't seen this movie in a while, this movie is funny.
It's worth going back to. Yeah. It's worth. And also if you're looking for kind of both iconic and influential films from the 2000s, this is top five, right?
Yes.
Top 10 for sure.
Oh yeah. I mean, this, especially with the ubiquity of the soundtrack and the way it sort of helped launch a bunch of music careers and, you know, increased popularity in bands like The Shins. And, you know, I think Nick Drake and Colin Hay both had like an increase in popularity after this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, like, with how successful that is, this movie is I think much more culturally important than a lot of people give it credit for these days. And I really enjoyed revisiting this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I enjoyed revisiting this because, you know, you had several, like, even artists come out of this and have bigger careers musically just because of what was going on with the cultural blow up that this had in the mid 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, this movie didn't just define like a film aesthetic and film themes, but every single one of these bands, and in particular the song Such Great Heights, became among the most important indie hits of the entire decade.
Well, and I think what's wild about that is when I think of Garden State and I think of Such Great Heights, I think of the version,
the Postal Service version, right?
The Postal Service version.
Too, but it's actually the Iron and Wine version. I know.
It's the Iron and Wine version. And both times I've watched the film, I just am surprised by that.
Right.
But I think that just goes back to the ubiquity of the UPS whiteboard commercials where they use that every time. And I think they use that every time because A, the song was kind of sort of from the Garden State soundtrack. So there was like their indie cred. And B, it was literally the postal service, and it was UPS.
Yeah. Before we get into some of the soundtrack stuff, I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, but the one other thing that I thought was handled really, really well in the plotting is that this is one of those movies that kind of uses that trope from The Big Chill where there's like a death and it causes everybody to kind of like return home and sort of take stock of where they are based on how they reconnect with like high school friends and kind of, you know, like old places. Yeah. And there's like tons and tons of movies that have used that trope over and over and over again. And books and stuff like,
I mean, it's a really excellent reason for a bunch of disparate people who are out of touch to be forced to come back into contact.
Exactly. Which means that it can be used in an incredibly haphazard and lazy way. And it's been used that way a number of times. Like the most recent thing I can think of that uses that Big Chill is It Part Two, right? Same thing. Suicide causes everybody to come back to their hometown. Granted, it was about a killer alien clown, but
very similar.
Generally, it's
movie.
Not about that. So,
yeah, I mean, you definitely don't have like the lazy aesthetic where, or the lazy plot where, oh, I have to reconnect with my family and I'm being forced to hang out with them. Like, he resolves his issues with his dad by not being around his dad.
It's a very excellent application of that trope. It's a very good interpretation of it.
Like, so much about what he experiences in the, you know, week or so that he's back in New Jersey. Like, he learns that and applies it to his relationship with his dad and just goes like, no, I'm forgiving myself for this mistake because I was a kid and I didn't mean for it to happen. And the consequences were unforeseeable by a 9-year-old me.
Right.
And he's like, you have to understand that I'm not going to beat myself up for this anymore. So you can't beat me up with it anymore either. Like you can. And that's why Bilbo is so good in that role as the father, even though like he's 3 feet shorter than Zach Braff.
Right.
He says that one line of like, I'm glad you came back for your mother's funeral. I'm glad you could fit it in. And he just says it with such disdain.
Yeah.
And it's just like, he's this dad is, yes, yeah. this has been a stick that he's been hitting his son with for years. And for, decent enough reasons. He obviously at least feels his son is partly to blame for his wife's predicament. But like, yeah, you get that early on of like, oh, why would he not want to hang, be around his dad? And then it's like, oh, yeah, that's it. It's because this is constant reminder of the fact that his dad at least partially blames him.
This next bit, I don't even think this is going to be. Because it's so visual, I don't think this is going to work on the podcast very well. But one thing that I loved about Natalie Portman's acting, I have to say, because you're talking about Ian Holm, but there's the one scene where they go visit Zach Braff's friend and he's like, tug your earlobe. First of all, I love that scene with the flaming arrow coming down. And so she tugs her earlobe. But if you notice, there are a couple other scenes later on where they're together and something's happening and she just does that. But it's like, it's not pointed out. Like, yeah. Natalie Portman just is a great actress and just can just integrate that. And it's good.
She really is, which makes the first couple of scenes like just she's at 110 and I need her at like an 80.
Right.
But once she settles into that character, like there's no other actress in that time and period that you would want playing that role because she gets it. Like, yeah, she's a little bit manic pixie, but also like, she's coming from a place of honesty. Like, why is she constantly lying? Well, because she's embarrassed about her health situation or her parental situation or the fact that her brother is a kind of sort of not adopted brother.
Right. Like,
everything. It her genuine awkwardness and her penchant for lying comes from a place of honesty because Natalie Portman clearly, like, grounds that performance in a reality that the character feels believable.
I'm glad we revisited this one. I have I went through Hulu to see what other movies of that era are around, and like I've got Napoleon Dynamite queued up for this evening.
I'm glad you want to watch that film.
Yeah,
that's not for me.
Are you gonna eat your tots?
I was recently listening to a podcast where they were talking about they were doing a deep dive into what's his name, John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell movies.
Yeah,
and they're like, yeah, watch Blades of Glory with Napoleon Dynamite. Like, they don't even know John the guy's Hedder. Name.
Yeah,
and these guys are professional podcasters who that's their full time job, and they're like, I don't know that fucker's name. It's just fucking Napoleon Dynamite, and I'm like, well. At least he's got that, that's got to count for something, but no one cares who he is. So,
yeah, he also, I looked it up, but he got paid $1,000 for that role. He paid $1,000. It took a month, but it was less than $500,000 budget. It made like over 40 million. I'm sure.
I hope he got back
40 million in the box office. I'm sure since then it's made tons of money.
Oh yeah.
It's a whole franchise, but,
Hopefully you got some distribution rights or something, because the rest of his career didn't pan out great.
Your mom goes to college. That movie's fantastic.
I hate that fucking movie.
I would love.
I don't think that movie's funny.
Yeah.
We saw Nacho Libre together, and I thought that film was the worst thing I'd ever seen.
Get that corn out of my face. You didn't like that scene?
I remember a scene.
The corn.
I remember a scene in the bathroom. Like, there were a couple of funny moments, but for the rest of the movie, I was like, I hate this. I actively the same director. Hate yeah. this. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I that's just not my cup of tea, that sort of comedy. Obviously, it was at least $40 million worth of some people's comedy.
Right.
But yeah, that Napoleon Dynamite, not one of my favorite films. I don't think I've ever been able to make it through that movie.
We should revisit that. Ooh. I mean, I would love, we have our own plan for June, yes. which we should stick to, but I would love it if we did our own, like, whatever fraction life crisis occurs in your 30s, like, film festival, and watched a bunch of stuff from when we were in high school.
Okay, such as?
Rushmore? Royal Tenenbaums, mm-hmm. for sure. Eternal Sunshine, I think we could revisit. Like I said, I Heart Huckabees. I bet that movie probably sucks now. At the time, it was kind of like, I don't know if this is okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever saw that.
I mean, the cast is amazing.
Yeah.
Naomi Watts, Jude Law, Dustin Hoffman, Mark Wahlberg. There's a scene with Mark Wahlberg in that movie that I like. Every time I think of it, I crack up. Where he's a firefighter who is so. He can't reconcile his role as like a lifesaver with gasoline and all of the energy used to fight fires as being environmentally destructive. So he rides a bicycle. And there's a scene where the fire truck is stuck in traffic and he gets to this fire first on a bicycle. Like, he can't do anything. He's like, I don't know where you guys are. I'm at the fire. I don't know where you guys are.
That's a perfect like role for him to play.
It's like the best. Oh God. So like I would totally do some of those. And there were even like some clones of those movies, like Nacho Libre being kind of like attempting to capitalize on Napoleon Dynamite, or like Elizabethtown attempting to capitalize on Garden State. And we could even see some of those.
And Elizabethtown is actually the film that the term Manic Pixie Chick
comes from. Yeah.
That's the essence of it right there. Is just someone who exists so that someone else's plot can happen.
Yeah. And then like even Juno was a movie where it's like, what if we just make a quirky movie that's a vehicle for a soundtrack?
All right, Mike, I just want to talk about a couple other things that I really loved about this movie.
Let's do it.
I really love the line, don't tease me about my hobbies. I don't tease you about being an asshole.
I loved that. Oh, God, that one stuck out to me, too.
There's so many witty, like, smart lines. Like, that's totally something your friend would have said to you.
Right.
Oh, my God. I love the whole Skarsgård character.
He also has the... Desert Storm card collection.
Yeah, oh my God, it's so fucking funny. He's like, no, it's probably worth like $1-$2. He's like, what? It's an investment. Don't you know about investing? His whole relationship with his mother, he's like, Mom, shut up about the goddamn tapes. And Jean Smart just playing like...
She was great too. Oh, everyone was great. It was the casting delightful. Was fantastic. Yeah.
But yeah, just playing like a drugged out, like kind of like, I mean, she's just fucking one of their high school friends. Like, it's so shitty. But like, there's also a lot of love in that relationship, like clearly. Oh man. It's just little vignettes like that where it just feels so real and funny and idiosyncratic. But yeah, I also really loved when Peter Skarsgård like tries to big time everybody, and he like Largemouth shows up to that college party or whatever, and
right,
he's like, he's here for a press junket, and then he walks up to him and he's like, yo, you like that?
Like that?
It's called improv. Like, Largemouth doesn't know what fucking improv is. He's a working actor. Because he was in that movie where he played the retarded quarterback.
Right, I love that.
That whole scene, Natalie Portman uses that word like a sniper.
Yeah. Are you really retarded?
Oh my God. I thought you were really retarded. I mean, it's, you know, try not to use the R word, but that's so fucking funny. And I mean, great. It's perfect 2004 of like It wasn't out of the cultural zeitgeist of like well-to-do, well-meaning people. It's just like you said that word, and Natalie Portman says it a whole lot.
I still have a soft spot for that word.
I get it. All right, Mike, let's take a quick little break here and we'll get back to talk a little bit more about the soundtrack.
Sure.
Here's what's coming up on Subject of Blackout. Folks, life's simple. You make choices and you don't look back. And that's why Mike and I are doing the Furiously Fast Film Fest. All throughout June, Subject to Blackout is being taken over by Dom, Han, Letty, and the gang as we binge all of the Fast and the Furious movies in anticipation of the release of Fast 9 in theaters and on HBO Max on the 25th of June. Mike and I are going to be seeing most of these films for the first time, so we're going to do what we do best. We improvise, alright? Listen, Mike and I don't have friends. We got family. And they're not that interested in us either, so we're deep diving a much-beloved, but very missed by us, film franchise. All you know by now that I live my life a podcast at a time, and I know it don't matter if you pod for a minute or an hour. Pod, it's pod. So join us, won't you, as we watch two movies every week in June as we try to close the gap before Fast 9 crosses the finish line. So, Mike, does the excellent use of the song Don't Panic by Coldplay make Coldplay okay?
See, I remember so the way what happened with the soundtrack,
just say you love Coldplay.
I will always hate Coldplay. I mean, I without listening to this soundtrack, you knew every single song on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
So either because you were avoiding the songs because they were on the soundtrack, or because this was like the only thing you listened to. And but the way this soundtrack became a pretty key like cultural phenomenon was unique for the time. So you had, this is 2004. So we had MySpace and Facebook was just becoming a thing for college students. And like at that time, I don't know if Facebook still has this because I haven't been on there in years, but there was a section for music you liked. And then like that was basically like a giant section for that kind of stuff in MySpace, and people would kind of signal what sort of music they liked was like the Garden State soundtrack. It became like a meme before memes.
Yeah. I mean, it was like you said, it was signaling like, yo, I know cool hip indie bands. Like but I only know these. Them from this one yeah. album. But I know cool hip indie bands. Like, I know the Shins. Like, name three Shin songs. They're like, I know two.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, I, as somebody who got deeply invested in the, like, the music of this era, I ended up kind of, like, reacting against this soundtrack in particular and using it as a way to gauge, you know, whether or not people were really into music. And because that's the type of thing that you do as a high school student when you're a dick. So, but that's, you know,
hey, we were all dicks.
Yeah. But I don't choose, you know, romantic partners based on what bands they like anymore. I've grown up a lot.
good job, Mike.
I know. So it was cool revisiting it. I still hate Coldplay. fuck Coldplay.
It's a good song.
Yeah.
It's a good song and it works at the beginning of this movie.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically everything was from like this era except for Nick Drake and Simon and Garfunkel, which were like late 70s. But like it's a very aesthetically consistent album.
Yeah.
It's
I mean, really,
like I was describing this to you in a text message, but it's not like slit your wrist kind of acoustic. It's like take a lot of pills and never wake up acoustic.
Which is, it sounds like that's what his mom did. So it yeah. fits. It fits. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say like a lot of this music too, it's less about, and I think this works for me because this is kind of how I consume music, is it's less about the words and more about the feelings of the songs.
Yeah.
I mean, he basically becomes enamored with Natalie Portman to Caring is Creepy by the Shins.
Yeah.
And the title, Caring is Creepy, should let you know that this song isn't exactly romantic. And nothing the Shins were putting out in that era was anything other than nihilistic, like horrifically apathetic to the world music, but it all just sounded so sonically unique and fun at times. And it didn't matter that he was talking about how there was no right way to run the world, so who cares? You know, it was just the Shins sounded good and sounded fun. But much like the Shins live, there wasn't a whole lot good down deep. That didn't make sense. I just want to say this Shins suck live.
They sucked. I can't remember whether or not we heard them do new. We must have heard them do New Slang and Caring is Creepy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because we saw them, what, 2006? Yeah. Yes. So they didn't even have, like, their albums were like 20 minutes long. So we must have heard their entire catalog at that point. They had two albums.
Yeah, they played every song that they had with 5 minutes of tuning in between each song. While What's His Bucket stared at the other three being like, I'm going to kick you out of this band so soon.
Man, I'm going back through O Inverted World. This was a great album. So was Shoots to an Arrow, but that was the second one. You know, Frou Frou was one of the songs that I totally forgot about, and that's a terrific electronic song from the mid 2000s, which you didn't run into very much. That was a very guitar driven window of time.
Yeah, and there's that, and I mean, Thievery Corporation's Lebanese Blonde is like a big outsider on that album, but it works in the scene that it's in because you're entering a world that is unknown to the characters.
It is, yeah. So if there was a band that was redeemed for me on the soundtrack, it was Thievery Corporation, in part because in this era, I did not listen to Thievery Corporation because they were on the Garden State soundtrack. I listened to the Shins because they were rad. I didn't listen to Thievery Corporation, but it was a great, I remember the song too. This is a great song. It's as far as movie soundtracks go, this is a cohesive mixtape. It comes off like a good playlist or a good mixtape.
Yeah. Like, and again, like the songs being chosen for their feeling, like, I don't know what In the Waiting Line is specifically about, but it is the perfect song to watch people slowly get high to.
Yeah, that's a great song that I totally forgot about too. Like, there's good stuff here, man. This is like a really, yeah. Like, if I could recover my MySpace, I would put Garden State Soundtrack on there.
And has there ever been a song less on a soundtrack than Winding Road by Bonnie Somerville?
That is what's so funny. Like, sometimes you're on Spotify and you can see people's experiences with an album by when they drop off on the plays, right? So you can tell that people aren't going on Spotify. They're not going to the actual compilation as much because, like, Coldplay will have 100 million listens. Caring is Creepy has like 50 million. Like, they're kind of all over the place. People are clearly kind of doing their own thing and listening to those bands themselves. But nobody is listening to Bonnie Somerville.
That's because the only appearance of this song is deep into the credits after Frau Frau's Let Go is done. And then Winding Road comes on and you're like, what? Wait, there's another song in this that isn't one of the 12 great songs that we've previously heard.
Right.
And it's like everyone had left the theater by the time this song came on. So they should have just done like a Huey Lewis in the News, like, welcome to Garden State. Because that's the other thing. They don't do the Family Guy thing where they say, like, they said it. Garden State is just never mentioned. And that makes the title 10,000 times better.
Yes, exactly.
All right, Mike, do you have anything else to say about either Garden State or the Garden State soundtrack?
I don't. But like I said, I am so pleased by our choice or your choice this week, because like I said, I do not think I would have revisited any of this if we hadn't done this for the show.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. I was hoping that would be your takeaway.
Yeah.
And this podcast isn't real. I've just been doing it to slowly catfish you into watching this movie again.
Yeah.
Because
Zach.
Because like I said, my biggest takeaway the time I watched it a couple months ago was like, holy shit, this movie's fucking hilarious. And
it's really funny.
I'm very, very happy that it stands up to the test of time of 15 years. And the soundtrack is still amazing and inspiring. And the you know, you have to hand it to, you know, White Scrubs. He really nailed this movie. And really, I mean, from the directing to the writing to the acting and the casting, he just nailed it all. So congrats to Zach Braff.
Way to go, Zach.
I know you're a listener. You're
listening out there.
You're a big time listener, Subject to Blackout, one of our original fans. So yeah,
this is for you.
I thank you for listening. All right, Mike, now that we've discussed that, is there anything that you have been watching or consuming or listening to this week?
Not really. I am kind of hunkering down for a couple weeks, and I'm looking for rumors of E3 since that's happening in 2 weeks. So I'm trying to figure out what all my video game purchases are going to be for the rest of the year.
Fair enough. I have recently been revisiting since I got Hulu for a week so that I could watch this for free. One of the other things that is on Hulu that I love, that I think I own on like iTunes or something, but saw on Hulu and immediately started rewatching, was Party Down.
I don't know that one.
Ooh. Party Down was a Starz TV show in like 2009, 2010. And so basically the plot of Party Down is it's a catering company staffed entirely by like failed LA people, whether it's actors or comedians or writers. But it stars Lizzie Kaplan, Ken Marino, Adam Scott, Ryan Hansen's a little less well known, but Martin Starr, Jane Lynch. Jane Lynch. In the second season, Jane Lynch gets replaced by Megan Mullally.
Okay.
Because Jane Lynch actually, from being on Party Down, got Glee.
Oh, nice.
So she had to leave. But it's just two seasons and it's a coherent like story throughout. But there's just every different episode is a different event that they're catering. Mm. And so like one time they're catering like a Marilyn Manson type character's like after party at like an arena. One time they're supposed to be catering the birthday party for, what's his name? They're supposed to be catering the birthday party for Steve Guttenberg. And Steve Guttenberg in the first like minute of the show shows up like to his own house with them in the driveway. Like, where the hell is Steve Guttenberg? And he's like, oh, my friends threw me a surprise party. I forgot to cancel you. And they're like, oh, well, you know, you could just eat the deposit and we'll just go. He's like, are you going to like throw away all that food and stuff? And they're like, well, yeah. He's like, well, fuck it. Let's just have a party together. So they just have a party at Steve Guttenberg's house.
As one does.
And it's very, very funny. Yeah, there's just all they do an after show for like a small theater troupe. And the theater people are like, clearly this is written by people who've been in close proximity to theater people.
Right. Because
the theater people in this are like the worst theater people possible. And it's so accurate. Yeah, no, there's just a lot of really fantastic scenes. And then like, you know, there is a Sword and Garden State like malaise and sadness to some of it, but also it's just a super funny comedy.
I'll check it out. I have Hulu.
It's true. You do. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap us up this week for Subject to Blackout. For those of you listening along, please head on over to subjecttoblackout.com, or you can reach out to us and find all of our links on our socials at subjecttoblackout.com, including our Instagram, Patreon, Twitch, Twitter, and YouTube. You can also feel free to go on any of those and rate, review, and subscribe. And lastly, you can find Mike on Instagram and Twitter at NameTakenPodcast. And Mike, I just want to thank you for joining me.
Right on.
All right, until next time.